Chapter 4. Sarah Sands. The screw steamship Sarah Sands, apostrophe 1330 registered tons, was chartered by the East India Company in the autumn of 1858 for the conveyance of troops to India. She was commanded by John Squire Castle. She took out a part of the 54th Regiment, upwards of 350 persons, besides the wives and children of some of the men, and the families of some of the officers. All went well till the 11th November, when the ship had reached Lat. 14 S, long. 56 E, upwards of 400 miles from the Mauritius. Between 3 and 4 p.m. on that day a very strong smell of fire was perceived arising from the after deck, and upon going below into the hold, Captain Castle found it to be on fire, and immense volumes of smoke arising from it. Endeavors were made to reach the seat of the fire, but in vain. The smoke and heat were too much for the men. There was, however, no confusion. Every order was obeyed with the same coolness and courage with which it was given. The engine was immediately stopped. All sail was taken in, and the ship brought to the wind, so as to drive the smoke and fire, which was in the after part of the ship, astern. Others were, at the same time, getting fire hoses fitted and passed to the scene of the fire. The fire, however, continued to increase, and attention was directed to the ammunition contained in the powder magazines, which were situated one on each side the ship immediately above the fire. The starboard magazine was soon cleared. But by this time the whole of the after part of the ship was so much enveloped in smoke that it was scarcely possible to stand, and great fears were entertained on account of the port magazine. Volunteers were called for, and came immediately, and, under the guidance of Lieutenant Hughes, attempted to clear the port magazine, which they succeeded in doing, with the exception, as was supposed, of one or two barrels. It was most dangerous work. The men became overpowered with the smoke and heat, and fell, and several, while thus engaged, were dragged up by ropes, senseless. The flames soon burst up through the deck, and running rapidly along the various cabins, set the greater part on fire. In the meantime Captain Castle took steps for lowering the boats. There was a heavy gale at the time, but they were launched without the least accident. The soldiers were mustered on deck. There was no rush to the boats, and the men obeyed the word of command, as if on parade. The men were informed that Captain Castle did not despair of saving the ship, but that they must be prepared to leave her if necessary. The women and children were lowered into the port lifeboat, under the charge of Mr. Very, third officer, who had orders to keep clear of the ship until recalled. Captain Castle then commenced constructing rafts of spare spars. In a short time, three were put together, which would have been capable of saving a great number of those on board. Two were launched overboard, and safely moored alongside, and then a third was left across the deck forward, ready to be launched. In the meantime the fire had made great progress. The whole of the cabins were one body of fire, and at about 8:30 p.m. flames burst through the upper deck, and shortly after the mizzen rigging caught fire. Fears were entertained of the ship paying off, in which case the flames would have been swept forwards by the wind. But fortunately the after braces were burnt through, and the main yard swung round, which kept the ship's head to wind. About 9 p.m. A fearful explosion took place in the port magazine, arising, no doubt, from the one or two barrels of powder which it had been impossible to remove. By this time the ship was one body of flame, from the stern to the main rigging, and thinking it scarcely possible to save her, Captain Castle called Major Brett, then in command of the troops, for the colonel was in one of the boats, forward, and, telling him that he feared the ship was lost, requested him to endeavor to keep order amongst the troops till the last, but, at the same time, to use every exertion to check the fire. Providentially, the iron bulkhead in the after part of the ship withstood the action of the flames, and here all efforts were concentrated to keep it cool. No person, apostrophe says the captain, can describe the manner in which the men worked to keep the fire back. One party were below, keeping the bulkhead cool, and when several were dragged up senseless, fresh volunteers took their places, who were, however, soon in the same state. At about 10 p.m., the main topsail yard took fire. Mr. Welch, one quartermaster, and four or five soldiers, went aloft with wet blankets, and succeeded in extinguishing it, but not until the yard and mast were nearly burnt through. The work of fighting the fire below continued for hours, and about midnight it appeared that some impression was made, and after that, the men drove it back, inch by inch, until daylight, when they had completely got it under. The ship was now in a frightful plight. The after part was literally burned out, merely the shell remaining, the port quarter blown out by the explosion. 15 feet of water in the hold. Apostrophe, apostrophe, the gale still prevailed, and the ship was rolling and pitching in a heavy sea, and taking in large quantities of water abaft. The tanks, too, were rolling from side to side in the hold. As soon as the smoke was partially cleared away, Captain Castle got spare sails and blankets aft to stop the leak, passing two hawsers round the stern, and setting them up. The troops were employed bailing and pumping. This continued during the whole morning. In the course of the day the ladies joined the ship. The boats were ordered alongside, but they found the sea too heavy to remain there. The gig had been abandoned during the night, and the crew, under Mr. Wood, fourth officer, had got into another of the boats. The troops were employed the remainder of the day bailing and pumping, and the crew securing the stern. All hands were employed during the following night bailing and pumping, the boats being moored alongside, where they received some damage. At daylight, on the 13th, the crew were employed hoisting time boats, the troops were working manfully bailing and pumping. Latitude at noon, 13 degree 12 min. South. At 5 p.m., the foresail and foretopsail were set, the rafts were cut away, and the ship bore for the Mauritius. On Thursday, the 19th, she sighted the island of Rodrigues, and arrived at Mauritius on Monday the 23rd. The Nile and Trafalgar are not more glorious to our country, are not greater victories than these won by our merchant seamen. And if you look in the captain's reports of any maritime register, you will see similar acts recorded every day. I have such a volume for last year, now lying before me. In the second number, as I open it at hazard, Captain Roberts, master of the ship Empire, from Shields to London, reports how on the 14th ult, the 14th December, 1859, he, being off Whitby, discovered the ship to be on fire between the main hold and boilers. Got the hose from the engine laid on, and succeeded in subduing the fire, but only apparently. For at 7 the next morning, the Dutchy in Bering S. SS. E 7 miles distance, the fire again broke out, causing the ship to be enveloped in flames on both sides of midships. Got the hose again into play and all hands, to work with buckets, to combat with the fire. Did not succeed in stopping it till 4 p.m., to effect which, were obliged to cut away the deck and topsides, and throw overboard part of the cargo. The vessel was very much damaged and leaky. Determined to make for the Hummer. Ship was run on shore, on the mud, near Grimsby Harbor, with 5 feet of water in her hold. The donkey engine broke down. The water increased so fast, as to put out the furnace fires and render the ship almost unmanageable. On the tide flowing, a tug towed the ship off the mud, and got her into Grimsby to repair. On the 2nd of November, Captain Strickland, of the Urchis Briganton, from Liverpool to Yarmouth, U.S., encountered heavy gales from W.N.N. W to W.S.W., in lat. 43 degree. N, long. 34 degree. W, in which we lost jib, foretopmast, staysail, topsail, and carried away the foretopmast stays, bobstays and bowsprit, headsails. Cut water and stern, also started the wood ends, which caused the vessel to leak. put her before the wind and sea, and hove about 25 tons of cargo overboard, to lighten the ship forward. Slung myself in a bowline, and by means of thrusting 2 1-2-inch rope in the opening, contrived to stop a great portion of the leak. December 16th. The crew continuing night and day at the pumps, could not keep the ship free, deemed it prudent for the benefit of those concerned to bear up for the nearest port. On arriving in lat. 48 degree. 45 N. Long. 23 degree. W. Observed a vessel with a signal of distress flying. Made towards her, when she proved to be the Bark Carlton, apostrophe waterlogged. The captain and crew asked to be taken off. Hove to, and received them on board, consisting of 13 men. And their ship was abandoned. We then proceeded on our course, the crew of the abandoned vessel assisting all they could to keep my ship afloat. We arrived at Cork Harbor on the 27th ult. Captain Coulson, master of the brig Thello, reports that his brig foundered off Portland, December 27, encountering a strong gale, and shipping two heavy seas in succession, which hove the ship on her beam ends. Serving no chance of saving the ship, took to the longboat, and within 10 minutes of leaving her saw the brig founder. We were picked up the same morning by the French ship Commerce de Paris, apostrophe Captain Tombrell. Here, in a single column of a newspaper, what strange, touching pictures do we find of seamen's dangers, vicissitudes, gallantry, generosity. The ship on fire, the captain in the gale slinging himself in a bowline, to stop the leak, the Frenchman in the hour of danger coming to his British comrades' rescue, the Brigantine almost a wreck, working up to the bark with the signal of distress flying, and taking off her crew of 13 men. He then proceeded on our course, the crew of the abandoned vessel assisting all they could to keep my ship afloat. What noble, simple words! What courage, devotedness, brotherly love! Do they not cause the heart to beat, and the eyes to fill? This is what seamen do daily, and for one another. One lights occasionally upon different stories. It happened, not very long since, that the passengers by one of the great ocean steamers were wrecked, and, after undergoing the most severe hardships, were left, destitute and helpless, at a miserable coaling port. Amongst them were old men, ladies, and children. When the next steamer arrived, the passengers by that steamer took alarm at the haggard and miserable appearance of their unfortunate predecessors, and actually remonstrated with their own captain, urging him not to take the poor creatures on board. There was every excuse, of course. The last arrived steamer was already dangerously full. The cabins were crowded. There were sick and delicate people on board, sick and delicate people who had paid a large price to the company for room, food, comfort, already not too sufficient. If 14 of us are in an omnibus, will we see 3 or 4 women outside, and say, "Oh, men, because this is the last bus, and it rains"? Of course not. But think of that remonstrance, and of that Samaritan master of the Purchase Brigantine. In the winter of 53 I went from Marseille to Civita Vecchia, in one of the magnificent P&O ships, the Aletta, the master of which subsequently did distinguished service in the Crimea. This was his first Mediterranean voyage, and he sailed his ship by the charts alone, going into each port as surely as any pilot. I remember walking the deck at night with this most skillful, gallant, well-bred, and well-educated gentleman, and the glow of eager enthusiasm with which he assented, when I asked him whether he did not think a ribbon or order would be welcome or useful in his service. Why is there not an Order of Britannia for British seamen? In the merchant and the Royal Navy alike, occur almost daily instances and occasions for the display of science, skill, bravery, fortitude in trying circumstances, resource in danger. In the first number of the Cornhill magazine, a friend contributed a most touching story of the McClintock expedition, in the dangers and dreadful glories of which he shared, and the writer was a merchant captain. How many more are there, and, for the honor of England, may there be many like him? Gallant, accomplished, high-spirited, enterprising masters of their noble profession. Can our fountain of honor not be brought to such men? It plays upon captains and colonels in seemly profusion. It pours forth not liberal rewards upon doctors and judges. It sprinkles mayors and aldermen. It bedews a painter now and again. It espirited a baronetcy upon two, and bestowed a coronet upon one noble man of letters. Diplomatists take their bath in it as of right, and it flings out a profusion of glittering stars upon the nobility of the three kingdoms. Cannot Britannia find a ribbon for her sailors? The navy, royal or mercantile, is a service. The command of a ship, or the conduct of her, implies danger, honor, science, skill, subordination, good faith. It may be a victory, such as that of the Arasans. It may be discovery, such as that of the Ox. It may be heroic disaster, such as that of the Erkenhead. And in such events merchant seamen, as well as royal seamen, take their share. Why is there not, then, an Order of Britannia? One day a young officer of the Euryalus may win it, and, having just read the memoirs of Lord Dundonald, I know who ought to have the first Grand Cross. Asterisk Prince Alfred was serving on board the frigate Euryalus when this was written. On some late great victories. On the 18th day of April last I went to see a friend in a neighboring crescent, and on the steps of the next house, beheld a group something like that here depicted. A newsboy had stopped in his walk, and was reading aloud the journal which it was his duty to deliver. A pretty orange girl, with a heap of blazing fruit, rendered more brilliant by one of those great blue papers in which oranges are now artfully wrapped, leant over the railing and listened. And opposite the nymphum descentum there was a capering, and acute-eared young satirist of a crossing sweeper, who had left his neighboring professional avocation and chance of profit, in order to listen to the tale of the little newsboy. That intelligent reader, with his hand following the line as he read it out to his audience, was saying, "And he now Tom coming up smiling after his fall he delivered a rattling clinker upon the Benicia boy's potato trap, but was met by a punisher on the nose which, and see, or words to that effect. Betty at 52 let me in, while the boy was reading his lecture, and, having been some 20 minutes or so in the house, and paid my visit, I took leave. The little lecturer was still at work on the 51 doorstep, and his audience had scarcely changed their position. Having read every word of the battle myself in the morning, I did not stay to listen further, but if the gentleman who expected his paper at the usual hour that day experienced delay and a little disappointment, I shall not be surprised. I am not going to expatiate on the battle. I have read in the correspondent's letter of a northern newspaper, that in the midst of the company, assembled the reader's humble servant was present, and in a very polite society too, of vets, clergymen, men of letters, and members of both houses of parliament. If so, I must have walked to the station in my sleep, paid 3 guineas in a profound fit of mental abstraction, and returned to bed unconscious. For I certainly woke there about the time when history relates that the fight was over. I do not know whose colors I wore, the Benicians, or those of the Irish champion, nor remember where the fight took place, which, indeed, no somnambulist is bound to recollect. Ought Mr. Sayers to be honored for being brave, or punished for being naughty? By the shade of Brutus the Elder, I don't know. And George too. Apostrophe's time, there was a turbulent navy lieutenant, Handsome Smith he was called, his picture is at Greenwich now, in brown velvet, and gold and scarlet, his coat handsome, his waistcoat exceedingly handsome, but his face by no means the beauty. There was, I say, a turbulent young lieutenant who was broke on the complaint of the French ambassador, for obliging a French ship of war, to lower her topsails to his ship at Spithead. But, by the king's orders, Tom was next day made Captain Smith. Well, if I were absolute king, I would send Tom Sayers to the mill for a month, and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.